From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The tomato flew higher than anyone would have thought. I wonder how the other Olympic veggies have fared. Ahead on Only a Game, a roundup with John Powers, and a look ahead to the final week in Vancouver. Also, USA Biathlon sets the sights of its laser rifles on the 2014 Winter Games, and in front of a select audience, Tiger Woods apologizes. Also, we'll check into the New York City hotel that caters to the dogs of the annual Westminster Kennel Club show.
I've gotten requests for cheeseburger with no onions, meatballs with extra tomato sauce, chicken sandwiches, pepperoni pizzas. We've had a request before for 5 cheeseburgers for a pug, and apparently it made the coat shiny.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There's more to discuss just 1 week into the 21st Winter Games than we have time for today, so let's get right to some good Olympics talk with John Powers of the Boston Globe, who's currently in Vancouver. Hello, John.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. In yesterday's Men's Super G, Axel Lund Svindal took the gold. Bodie Miller, just 28 one-hundredths of a second behind him, won the silver. Does Miller's status as the top medal-winning American skier of all time help erase some of the negative perceptions of him?
I think it does. You know, I think the problem in 2006 was people came out of that saying, how about more ski, less talk? This time there's been very little talk and 2 medals where basically none were expected. I mean, this has been one of the great stories of the U.S. team here is how much, if you pardon the expression, loose chains have been able to pick up medals everywhere.
Loose change. I like it. All right. On Thursday, Evan Lysacek became the first American skater to capture Olympic gold since Brian Boitano did that back at the Calgary Games in 1988. I guess maybe something magical happens when American men go north of the border.
That's right. And I think, of course, this in Russia, this is a very controversial decision. As a matter of fact, Vladimir Putin sent Evgeny Plushenko, who was the defending champion, came in second, a telegram saying basically, your silver is as good as gold. Ooh. This is the first time the Russians have not won since 1992. And I think what mostly offends them is that Evan Lysacek won it without doing a quadruple jump. As far as Plushenko is, this isn't skating, it's dancing.
Mr. Putin taking a leaf from the old Brooklyn Dodgers book, We Was Robbed.
We Was Robbed.
On Tuesday, the always highly anticipated women's figure skating competition will begin. Hopes for the American contingent are not especially high, so which athletes representing which nations should we look for?
Well, this is going to be a huge competition for Asia. You've got Kim Yuna, who was the Korean world champion, up against her Japanese rivals. And this is huge. She is a rock star in Korea. She is their top figure skater. Korea not only has never won a gold in figure skating, they've never won a medal. So that will be an enormous day for Korea, and especially having lost the World Baseball Classic to the Japanese, they are hungry for redemption here.
During Wednesday's men's halfpipe competition, a tomato flew and totally radical expletives were shared in real time with American network viewers as well. And then on Thursday, an Aussie woman crashed the medal stand to take gold. Do you agree with me that it was a particularly interesting Olympiad for snowboarding?
It was. As a matter of fact, here is a sport that nobody understands and no one understands their lingo. I mean, basically, Sean White, who was the tomato, now he's being called the animal.
Oh.
He totally rinsed it, dude. He rinsed it.
Okay, I like it. John, Sean White, of course, went into these games as one of the more recognizable Winter Games athletes from the U.S. I gather he comes out 3 times as recognizable as when he went in.
He does. As a matter of fact, one of the fun facts here is that Sean White is believed to be the richest Winter Olympian here. Some people have estimated his income as about $8 million a year. Now, this is for a sport whose adherents thought it would be selling out to come to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that the X Games are their ultimate. So clearly snowboarding has gone a lot more mainstream, certainly in terms of the payoff.
Well, when you talk about that $8 million, does he get ownership of the $500,000 half pipe built for him in the Colorado Mountains, or does that still belong to one of his sponsoring companies?
Well, it would be pretty tough to remove it at this stage, so I think he gets to keep it.
Lindsey Vonn will go for her second medal of these games today in the Women's Super G competition. After witnessing the wipeouts in earlier ski races, I would hope that the mountain is less icy than it has been. Is that perhaps the case?
It does appear a little bit better in the men's Super G. There seem to be fewer wipeouts. It appears to be a little bit fairer course. The weather is held up there. They're able to do better course prep. And, of course, for Lindsey Vonn, this is another really good gold medal chance. The Super Combined, because of the slalom, is not her race. That said, she had a pretty good shot at a medal. So if she leaves here with two gold medals, she's a very happy woman.
In men's hockey, the Swiss found the holes in Canada's defense and almost beat that highly favored host team. Meanwhile, the Canadian women outscored their three opening round opponents by 41-2. Not exactly a squeaker among those games. So do you think Canada wins two gold medals in hockey?
Well, it's going to be interesting. Of course, if they don't win the men's gold medal, it doesn't matter how many medals they win elsewhere. The national pride is certainly at stake here. The worst nightmare here is that they would have to stand for the Russian anthem as the closing moment of these games. The big matchup, of course, is going to be Canada-U.S. women, which is almost foreordained. It didn't happen last time in Turin because the American women were beaten by Sweden. But that is clearly going to be a major chance for the U.S. But also what's happening here, the Russian men lost to Slovakia. So there was bratwurst and bratislava all night.
Bobsled, skiing aerials, and the brand new ski cross all commence today. Tomorrow will feature the U.S. men's hockey team against their Canadian counterpart. To what competition do you most look forward as we go into the final week of the Vancouver Games?
Well, I think bobsled is going to be quite interesting. The U.S. has not won the four-man since 1948. And Steve Holcomb, you've got basically a pilot who almost lost his sight. He is number one in the world right now. And this is an event, if you look back on the clips in 1948, it was four fat guys lured down by gravity. I mean, now this is a serious sport.
John, we at home see a certain amount of the Olympics, although only what the network chooses to show us. Tell me something about what one sees by being there that folks at home couldn't possibly know about.
Well, the one thing that you see is an awful lot of good behind-the-scenes stuff. What we can see, for example, as journalists are the athletes in the mixed zone afterwards. You really see a lot of the raw emotion after the medals happen. For example, seeing Evan Lysacek backstage was just remarkable. So this is what the games, I think, are really about, which is when you have the day of your life, when you most need the day of your life, as did Evan Lysacek.
And you get to see a guy who was perhaps even a little surprised at how good he was on that night.
Absolutely. Well, I think what he found out is he didn't have to jump out of the building. All he had to do was do what he did every day.
John Powers is in Vancouver covering the games for the Boston Globe, and he's our scribe of the circles here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Bill.
Regarding the sponsorship of the Olympic Games, it seems that some things never change, at least according to Dave Morand, the head of communications for the Coca-Cola Company in Canada. Coke has been an Olympic sponsor since 1928.
I can never imagine a future where we wouldn't sponsor the Olympics. For us, we view the Olympics as, you know, easily the most valuable marketing asset that we have.
But other things do change, at least with regard to some of the specific U.S. teams participating in these Winter Olympics. If you watch the Colbert Report on Comedy Central, you probably know that the U.S. speed skating team would have been skating on red ink, if not swimming in it, had not Colbert Nation come to the rescue. And Stephen Colbert isn't the only surprise sponsor at these games.
You give me an Olympian who was forced, you know, to either pick transplants, toupees, or hair restoration, who shaves his head, that's our guy or woman.
Todd Green is the founder and CEO of Headblade, a company that makes and markets a tool for people who shave their heads. Headblade sponsors skeleton racer Zach Lund, who was ousted from the Winter Olympics 4 years ago for using a hair restoration product that contained a banned substance. After that disappointment, Lund started shaving his head, and Todd Green noticed.
I watch the news. I'm very aware of any kind of, whether it's a famous person, like a John Travolta that shaves for a movie, But with Zach, it was such a heartbreaking story. You know, any guy faced with losing his hair and how insecure it makes you feel, and to have somebody who's like number one in the world in a chosen sport to think, oh my gosh, that guy's insecure about losing his hair, was way beyond my scope.
The benefits of Olympic sponsorship to a company like Coca-Cola are obvious and many. Lots of people watch the TV coverage of the games and see the commercials, not to mention the company logo all over Vancouver. The benefits accruing to Headblade for sponsoring a bald athlete are less obvious and dramatic. But according to Rick Burton, the David Falk Professor of Sports Management at Syracuse University, they may be no less significant, especially for employees and clients of the sponsoring company.
It could be that the contract that they've done is going to be tied to appearances at corporate sales meetings, or they're going to be able to send some of their key retailers to Vancouver, and they're going to get to hang out with this particular individual. So it may not always be that it's about straight visibility the way we think of traditional advertising.
Professor Burton may have been reading Michael Kupfer's mind. Black Diamond Technologies, the high-tech company of which Michael Kupfer is the CEO, is one of the sponsors of the U.S. Luge team. Kupfer, a skier and former hockey player, sought the relationship in part because he liked the fact that lugers don't have to excel at their sport as toddlers in order to have a shot at the Olympics, and he's found the lugers to be excellent partners and pals.
These are young kids, so it's not like, you know, you're not talking about the Michael Jordans of the world, you know, coming to your house. But at the same time, I mean, these kids are they're athletic and they're involved in these things that are, you know, bigger than themselves, obviously. And you know, for them to come by and just kind of hanging out, having a couple beers and some pizza, yeah, it was really a nice atmosphere. And like more like an extended family.
Opportunities for companies like Black Diamond Technologies and Headblade, as well as Colbert Nation, have come about because of the current economic climate. Some of the large international companies that had been sponsors in previous Olympics, Bank of America and Kodak, for example, pulled out of these games. According to Professor Burton, that caused teams to begin rethinking what sponsoring them should cost, which created opportunities for small and mid-sized companies and Colbert Nation.
When they lowered their prices, they probably came more in line with what other parties could afford. And because of that, you're seeing some new entrants to the sponsorship field, and I think some of them are going to be very successful.
That success could manifest itself in ways heretofore unimaginable.
You know, we're completely familiar with gifts at the university level, so that someone becomes the Phil Knight Professor of Marketing or the David Falk Professor of Sports Management. And you could see in the future, you know, the Stephen Colbert Chair of 5,000-meter speed skating.
Or the Chico's Bail Bonds bobsledder, or the Chicago Ice and Coal Company Dancer on Ice, who could wear the logo on the back of her sequined costume. The possibilities, like those of the games themselves, may seem endless. It's 19 minutes past the hour. In the wake of Valentine's Day, Jeff Ondash embraced a new world hugging record. Ondash, who goes by the name of Teddy McHuggin, clutched, grabbed, or surrounded with his arms 7,777 people in 24 hours. As he did so, his daughter Carly counted the hugs, thereby establishing a new record for embarrassment inflicted on a child by a parent, or so it would seem to me. Anyway, Ondash, a.k.a. McHuggin, achieved his record in Las Vegas while wearing a NASCAR-style driver's suit covered with hugging logos, whatever that might mean, and he wore a wrestling-style championship belt, which is pretty much all he had to do to merit mention on a program ostensibly concerned with sports.
I want to hug you and kiss you, sweet to the arm follow.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Mark Yost, author of Varsity Green, a behind-the-scenes look at culture and corruption in college athletics. But first, despite high hopes leading into the Vancouver Games, America has still never won an Olympic medal in biathlon. European countries dominate this winter sport, which combines cross-country skiing with riflery. As Only a Game Sadie Babbitts reports from Vancouver, a medal of any color could make biathlon a household word in the U.S.
Jeremy Tila came in ninth in the 10-kilometer sprint last Sunday, which represented the best result the U.S. has ever had at a Winter Olympics. Tila started the race in the rain, and his skis were almost perfectly waxed for the conditions. But other U.S. medal favorites, including Tim Burke and Lowell Bailey, weren't as well prepared. Halfway through the grueling race, that rain turned to snow, making it tough to shoot and even more difficult to ski. U.S. biathlete Lonnie Barnes also got caught in bad weather at last Saturday's 7.5-kilometer sprint. She says with biathlon, sometimes it doesn't matter how fit you are or how ready you are. Nature sometimes gets the best of you.
We kind of went into these games expecting that it might be different every single day. So you never know what you're going to get, whether you're going to get rain or snow or sleet or sunshine or ice.
Barnes knows. She's competed in biathlon now for about 10 years, along with her twin sister, Tracy. This is her second Olympic bid. She came in 23rd in Thursday's individual 15-kilometer event. Now she's looking forward to Tuesday's relay race.
Relay is probably my favorite because coming from a team sport with soccer, my passion is going out there and competing for a team.
Barnes, like many biathletes in the U.S., came to the sport through a chance encounter. She and her sister competed in various shooting competitions as kids. That's where the Barnes sisters bumped into a biathlon coach who worked out of the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs.
We met this guy who had been working with the U.S. biathlon team at the time, and he told us about it, and we're like, yeah, that's perfect. We'll try that. That should be fun, and it'd be a great way of staying in shape for soccer during the winter, and we just fell in love with it.
Lanny and Tracy took to the sport despite its physical and emotional challenges. Try this. Go outside and run around your house as hard as you can for about a half hour, then stop and try and thread a needle. That's kind of what biathlon is like. Barnes will ski as hard as she can around a track. She'll enter a shooting range and either shoot standing or drop onto her stomach in what's called prone position.
When you come in, your heart rate's, you know, 180 beats per minute or more, and you're breathing really hard, and a lot of people think that you try to get your heart rate to drop, but in this sport, the way it's evolved, you don't have time for that. The clock is ticking against you all the time.
She'll relax just enough to fire a .22 caliber bullet at five targets. The targets turn white when she hits them.
The first recorded biathlon competitions took place in the late 1700s and were between the Swedish and Norwegian border patrols.
That's Max Cobb. He's the executive director of the U.S. Biathlon Association, and he's been involved in the sport for 20 years.
And they had the ski troops there and were coming up with ways to make the long winters pass. And so those are the first documented biathlon competitions.
It's no wonder European countries dominate biathlon. Barnes says it's the most watched winter sport on TV in Europe.
Europeans, they are crazy about it. You know, we'll get anywhere from 20 to 30,000 spectators at each individual World Cup, even during the week. And it's just amazing atmosphere over there, having that many people cheer you on.
But biathlon in the U.S. is relatively obscure, and the U.S. competitors have suffered because of it. The team has historically lacked funding and resources. Cobb says the program began showing some promise for an Olympic medal back at the Salt Lake City Games in 2002.
We came pretty close, both in Salt Lake and then really close in Torino with Jay Häkkinen missing a medal by a split bullet in the individual 20-kilometer event. But after the Torino Games, the results were so inspiring for the Olympic Committee, they could see that there was a chance for the U.S. to win a medal in biathlon, and that completely changed their approach to working with us.
That ushered in a new era of biathlon in America. The U.S. Biathlon Association hired top European coaches, and the U.S. Olympic Committee increased its support from $250,000 to $1 million a year. Now the men's team has four seasoned Olympians, and the women's team is coming into their own. Cobb won't make predictions for the remaining Vancouver Games, but he's confident 4 years from now at the Games in Sochi, Russia, the U.S. will be strong medal contenders.
We've got some wonderful junior athletes coming along on the men's side. We've got good potential on the women's side to develop that as well.
Success in biathlon doesn't happen overnight. It takes years of training. Biathlete Haley Johnson is currently competing in Vancouver. She was introduced to the sport in 1996. She's now 28 and feels that her career is on the upswing. Johnson says winning an Olympic medal would mean more dollars from the U.S. Olympic Committee, money, she says, that would be used to help kids connect with biathlon.
We're a program that it's worth for them to invest in. And so with that money, I think the biggest thing that USBA is excited that they'd be able to do is to invest it into more grassroots programs, because it's a sport that it's difficult to enter in when you're at an older age. Because of the shooting skills, I think it really helps to learn that in an earlier setting.
There are major barriers for kids getting into biathlon in the U.S., simply because there are few cross-country courses with shooting ranges. Cobb says that's why U.S. Biathlon this year is rolling out a laser biathlon program.
So that any ski club in the country that wants to begin biathlon can order a set of mock laser biathlon rifles that only shoot a laser beam and a target that goes with it, and start their own biathlon club right next to their cross-country ski trail.
A ski club in Hanover, Connecticut is testing those laser rifles with kids. If all goes well, U.S. Biathlon plans to offer the rifles around the country, helping develop future Olympic biathletes. In the meantime, the present group hopes to win America's first biathlon medals in tomorrow's men's and women's mass start races, in Tuesday's 6-kilometer women's relay, and in the men's 7.5-kilometer relay on Friday. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
It's one thing to acknowledge that coaches of Division I football and basketball teams have been known to bend the rules in order to attract great players to their schools and keep them there. It's something else altogether to characterize the system within which those coaches and players operate as a meat grinder, and to suggest that the NCAA runs college sports pretty much the same way Tony Soprano conducted business from the back room of the Bada Bing Club. These are some of the conclusions to which Mark Yost comes in his new book, Varsity Green, subtitled A Behind-the-Scenes Look at Culture and Corruption in College Athletics. Mark Yost joins me now from WBEZ in Chicago. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Early in Varsity Green, you assert that, and I'm quoting now, college athletics has been corrupt since the day it was born. What specific evidence led you to that conclusion?
Well, the first ever intercollegiate athletic event was a rowing competition between Harvard and Yale on Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. And the event was actually put on by the guy who ran the New England and Montreal Railroad, and it was designed to increase ridership on the railroad. And so rather than have it on the Charles River, where you know there's lots of sculling today, they had it on Lake Winnipesaukee, and the players got Tiffany-encrusted miniature oars and all sorts of goodie bags, and the whole idea was to increase ridership on the railroad, not to watch these guys row.
Well, let's leap forward a little bit. When you began researching more current operations, you were somewhat surprised, I gather, by how much money college football's bowl games generate and by where the cash ended up. Why?
Well, you know, these bowl games started off as basically tourism tools. They were a means by which these communities, Pasadena, California, and Phoenix, Arizona, Miami, Florida, could lure northern people south in the winter. But these have turned into big money-making businesses now, thanks to the lobbyists for the bowls. They're all run as nonprofits. And the executives at some of these bowls, which pay out, you know, the BCS championship game pays out $18.5 million, they're making six and sometimes seven figures for what's basically, it is a year-round job, but it's about a month of intensive work.
The NCAA has often been accused of creating hopelessly arcane rules and then of failing to adequately follow up on the regulation that they invent. But you go a long step further than that. You call the NCAA a cartel and compare it to the mafia. Was that an overstatement?
I don't think it was. I think it was a bit of artistic license But it, seriously, if you think about it, the facade that Tony Soprano had was these sort of front companies that masked the real business going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what the NCAA does with the facade of amateurism. They have this facade up that masks what is the real business going on here, and it's a multi-billion dollar business that uses free labor in the form of student athletes to fill these stadiums and arenas and sell T-shirts and secure media rights. I'm not saying that the president of the NCAA is a gangster, but I'm saying that the two organizations use similar tactics to protect their turf.
You argue that the Division I basketball and football players recruited by the major college coaches are nothing more than the entertainment product. But don't some of these young men manage to learn something in the classroom between games, practices, supervised workouts in the gym, team meetings, and training meals?
They do, but here's my problem, and the media is really to blame for this, is that one of the most alarming statistics that is repeated in the book is the fact that about 3% of the kids that play high school basketball in this country get some sort of a college scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 2% of those kids ever make it to the NBA or the NFL, but yet this system, this idea that if they dedicate themselves wholly and fully to athletics at the expense of academics, it's their way out of the inner city or their way off the farm. It's just simply statistically not true.
The counterargument would run they do have an opportunity. I mean, they are on campus. Or is the responsibility they have to the team so great that they might as well not be on campus?
The problem is that from the time they're 9 years old, these adults continue to tell them, don't worry about academics, we'll take care of that, we'll take care of the grade. Derrick Rose, the star of the Chicago Bulls, Memphis had to vacate their entire season, including the national championship, because it was discovered that he had someone take his SAT for him.
Mm-hmm.
This is the real tragedy of this system, is that there's the adults that are supposed to be looking out for these kids, and they're doing anything but. They're looking out for the bottom line.
Mark, before reading your book, I knew that lots of universities and colleges provided tutoring and other academic services for their athletes. I was not aware of how elaborate some of those programs are. Tell us about the one at Notre Dame.
Notre Dame is actually the school that does it right. I mean, they do have serious academic standards for their athletes. They are expected to meet the same academic requirements as every other student. And Notre Dame is the only school in the country whose athletes have a higher graduation rate than their general student body. Now, it's by a couple of tenths of a point, but they really began this system back in the 60s. They started deciding that, hey, we need to make sure that we're as committed to our academic mission with these kids as we are to the athletic mission.
To what extent is the enthusiasm of fans responsible for the corruption that you've described?
The fan base really is what drives these media contracts. CBS is at the tail end of its March Madness contract. It paid $6.1 billion, that's with a B, for the rights to broadcast March Madness. And here's the interesting thing, Bill. The money gets spent as fast as it comes in. Ohio State has one of the largest athletic budgets in the country, $110 million. 2 years ago, they turned a $1,700 profit, and that was an anomaly. It's this separate little world within the university system all its own, and it cannot be tamed.
I'm speaking with Mark Yost, the author of Varsity Green, and you're listening to Only a Game. A lot of these fans have a lot to say about whether coaches stay or go and how much they're paid. There were examples in your book of booster groups at universities saying, go ahead, fire this guy with 2 years left on his contract. We'll pick up the $2.5 million you owe him.
They certainly will do that. The example I cite in the book, a couple of examples, but one of them is the North Carolina State Wolfpack Club. And they wanted a new college basketball coach, and they were willing to pay for it. And they committed upwards of $2 million a year to pay the coach's salary to get, quote, the right coach into that job and to make them national contenders again. The same thing goes on at other colleges and universities. North Carolina coaches' salaries are subsidized by their booster group. Phil Knight out at Oregon, he is perhaps the king of the boosters. He's given some $300 million to Oregon. He has a suite at the game in which he has a headset in which during the football games he can actually listen into the play calling from the booth down to the bench.
In your epilogue, you write that the issues of academic integrity, graduation rates, recruiting scandals, grade inflation, the facilities arms race, and overall influence of big money on college campuses are not getting better. They're getting worse. What led you to that conclusion?
Every year, the money seems to get bigger and more corrupting. At this point in time, I don't think there's a better example than the State University of New York at Binghamton. It was one of the most respected state universities within that system. And then 4 or 5 years ago, they decided that they wanted to be competitive in college basketball. And they brought in a coach, an assistant coach from Georgetown to sort of make it into a top-line Division I program. And he started cutting corners. And Nancy Zimpfer at the SUNY Chancellor just finished her investigation and found blatant recruiting violations, including on the part of Lois DeFleur, who is the president of SUNY Binghamton and who was widely and properly lauded for creating a really fine academic campus. But she just lost sight of everything with this focus on D1 basketball. And that's going on at a school like SUNY Binghamton, which is as infected as any of the big-name schools that we see regularly at the bowl games or March Madness.
Mark Yost is the author of Varsity Green, a behind-the-scenes look at culture and corruption in college athletics, published by Stanford University Press. He joined me from WBEZ in Chicago. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
An unlikely connection between golf and curling was established at the Vancouver Olympics when the members of the men's curling team from Norway revealed the inspiration for and source of their new uniform pants. The curlers purchased their training trousers from Loudmouth Golf, the same company that supplies golfer John Daly with the garish pants he favors. The Norwegians have been curling and sweeping in pants that feature a blue, gray, white, and red diamond pattern. Nor is this the first time those nutty Norwegians have pulled off some sort of spectacular sartorial stunt. At a tournament last winter, they all wore pink belts. Whoa, Nelly! Or, whoa, Norway. Said one of the Norwegian curlers, there are no rules against the pants, but there may be after this.
Well, you're a lot, man, baby.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, some hotels are having a rough time, as in rough, rough. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Sit, Bill.
I suppose I asked for that. Yesterday, as various fellows who aren't the world's best golfer prepared to play in the WGC Accenture Match Play Championship, the world's best golfer held a press conference. Good timing, eh?
Well, there was no good or bad timing for this. Frankly, I don't think anybody cares very much about the Accenture Match Play Tournament, except maybe Ernie Els, who seems to have gotten the vapors over this whole thing. All right, he gave a 15-minute speech. He put on all the right dumb show. I thought his talking about the Buddhist religion was fairly interesting and was the only part of the whole thing that caught me by surprise.
Well, for the record, let's listen to just a little bit of what Tiger Woods had to say.
I ran straight through the boundaries that a married couple should live by. I thought I could get away with whatever I wanted to. I felt that I had worked hard my entire life and deserved to enjoy all the temptations around me. I felt I was entitled.
Lots of people have been saying Tiger Woods probably felt he was entitled. Were you surprised by his bringing that up or by anything else that he had to say?
No, I mean, I mean, this was all the correct dumb show that had been put through marketing people and agentry and lawyers and everything else. I thought his delivery was a bit wooden and a bit mechanical, but maybe that was the only way he could get through it. I don't think he ever owed me an apology, but if that's the one I get, you know, that'll be fine by me.
On Thursday, one country became the very first to win its 100th Winter Olympic gold medal. Charlie, what country is that?
Kazakhstan.
Wrong.
Suriname.
Bermuda.
Fredonia. No, actually, it was
Norway.
Actually, it's the country I always root for other than the United States, the Olympics, which is Norway. First of all, I like the idea that it says Norge on their things because they look like they're being endorsed by a refrigerator company. Tora Berger won the 15K biathlon. For women to win Norway's 100th gold medal. It is amazing to me that neither Sweden nor the former Soviet Union ever got there first.
The two-man bobsled competition begins today. In training runs on Wednesday, 7 bobsleds crashed. That course, as well as some of the ski runs, have been described as exceptionally difficult. Do you suppose future Olympic venues will feature less dangerous runs and courses?
I think they're going to have to find a better equilibrium between sports and human-involved special effects than they did here. I mean, the ethos and the zeitgeist of the X Games has so infected the Olympics at this point that the standard sports are, you know, it's the athletes who are supposed to go higher, faster, and stronger, not the tracks. And I think they're going to have to look at this again because there is really no reason for a luge to go 95 miles an hour. The competition is just as entertaining if they go 75 or 80.
The National Hockey League has not agreed to free up their players to participate in the Olympics beyond these games. Sounds like another smart move by the guys who run the NHL, eh?
Well, you can kind of see their point. They don't want people to get injured, but I'll tell you what, watching these guys play for their country, they're a heck of a lot more entertaining than they are during the average NHL game. And frankly, if this men's tournament turns out to be the way I think it's going to turn out to be, it's going to be really hard for them not to come back next time.
Tracy McGrady, lately a disgruntled member of the Houston Rockets, is now a member of the New York Knicks. This move was part of a 3-team, 9-player trade involving the Sacramento Kings as well. Should we be paying attention to any trade involving those three teams?
No, not at all. And Tracy McGrady will now become a disgruntled member of the New York Knicks because they're just not going to be very good. And the most entertaining player they had, Nate Robinson, is now playing for the Celtics.
Well, should we pay attention to a trade involving the Cleveland Cavaliers?
Yes, because they weren't that far away from being a title contender, and Antoine Jameson, a terrific scorer, a great guy to have around, a perfect complement to LeBron James, that's a nice deal for them.
Michael Jordan celebrated his 47th birthday this week, and I understand that he is trying to buy himself a substantial present. What's that?
He wants to buy the Charlotte Bobcats, and David Stern says within 2 months the sale's going to be finalized. I guess it may turn out to be Michael Jordan owner. He hasn't proven to be a terrific general manager, so we'll see what he does while he's paying other people. There's absolutely no way he doesn't meddle, of course. And I think Larry Brown is aware of that.
Meddle? There's no way he doesn't activate himself. Spring training is underway in Florida and Arizona. Charlie, in Jupiter, Florida, where the St. Louis Cardinals train, their hitting coach, Mark McGwire, said of his steroid use, quote, "Listen, it got me the opportunity to get out there and get more at-bats." And wait a minute. Doesn't sound like an apology, does it?
Well, no, it's not. And I'm beginning to wonder, you know, and I wondered this at the time, if this stuff did get him back out there to do this, outside of the Maris family, who has a beef with that? I mean, would I have taken, you know, Sandy Koufax injecting himself with something so I could have gotten 5 more years of Sandy Koufax in the 60s? I'm not entirely sure I'd say no to that. Tiger did this whole thing because he was trying to pull a still active career out of the ditch. Mark McGwire's just trying to hold on to a job.
At the end of the 2009 season, American cyclist Floyd Landis said that he wanted to join a team that does more racing in Europe. However, as of this week, Mr. Landis might wish to revise that plan and perhaps race in all of Europe except for France. Why is that?
This case gets more wonderful almost by the day. The French have issued a national arrest warrant for Floyd Landis as part of a huge data hacking scam that included hacking into the data at a doping laboratory. And it looks like they're just seeking testimony from the guy. But, you know, if I'm Floyd Landis, I'm not getting anywhere near the French criminal justice system at this point.
Charlie, perhaps the most celebrated female athletes of the week were named Lindsay, who won a gold medal, and Julie, who won a couple of silver medals, and Haley, the Canadian, who on Wednesday night set a record for goals scored in Olympic ice hockey competition. But let us not forget Sadie, an exceptional bitch, Am I okay saying that?
Sadie, the Scottish Terrier.
I am okay.
The winner of the 112th Best in Show ribbon at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, which is one of those things that, like, a lot of people watch as kind of fun. But unfortunately, it happens at the same time as the Olympics this year. So all the people who would ordinarily be watching the Westminster Dog Show are now watching curling.
A terrible image of dogs and curling into my mind.
You lift
dogs being bowled over by these heavy stones.
No. You lift them up by the ears and slide them down the ice.
No. All right. It's quiz time, Charlie. A Swiss gentleman named Peter Collat broke a world record this week by not doing something. What was the nature of his achievement? If you can do that for about 29 minutes, you will break Peter Collat's record.
19 minutes and 21 seconds. He held his breath, and he held it underwater, which is a lot more dangerous than doing it in the studio
because
here.
Let me tell you. You can't cheat.
Did he actually turn blue? Was he just mad about something, or was he going for the record? Apparently, he was going for the record.
And finally, Charlie, the annual pancake race held in St. Albans, Hertfordshire, was plagued by a controversy that had hundreds of spectators booing the contestants. What happened?
They had to walk. They couldn't run this year, Bill. And these guys paid good money to watch massive pancake crashes in the far turn. Nobody goes to watch these things for the skill of the pancake walkers. They watch them to see pancake guys fall over. And according to the St. Albans County City Council tourism manager, people fall over in the dry. They will certainly fall over in the wet. It's hard to believe this guy isn't working at the Olympics.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine in the dry and in the wet as well. And he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game 2. Thank you, Charlie.
Slide the little Scotty.
The Winter Olympics have dominated the sports pages for the past couple of weeks, but last Monday and Tuesday, thousands of non-Olympian athletes participated in an even longer-running competition. The Westminster Kennel Club held its 134th annual gathering at New York's Madison Square Garden, where Sadie, a Scottish Terrier, won the coveted Best of Show title. Only a Game's Ron Schachter spent his time across the street at the hotel that once a year hosts a pack of elite performers.
The Hotel Pennsylvania, with its 1,700 rooms and tall red brick exterior, is one of New York's largest and oldest hotels. It stands directly across from Madison Square Garden and has hosted prize fighters, wrestlers, basketball, and hockey teams for more than 90 years. Even its phone number is famed as the city's longest running and the subject of a hit by the Glenn Miller Orchestra.
Pennsylvania 6-5,000!
But for 1 week, every February, the place goes to the dogs.
That's chaos.
Oh, she's peeing.
Someone's getting scared.
Although the Westminster Kennel Club lists dozens of dog-friendly places to stay during its annual rite of winter, the Hotel Pennsylvania gets the Doberman share, almost 1,000 of the competition's 2,500 annual entrants. On this Saturday morning, 2 days before the WKC show begins, the nearly block-long marble-floored lobby, lined with leather benches, could pass as a massive waiting room at the vets, as an assortment of purebred sprawl in crates on leashes or in their masters' laps. 2 years ago, the building was facing the wrecking ball, until its owners reconsidered. And while the old elegance has diminished, for this week, the pedigrees of its guests trump anything even the city's toniest uptown hotels can claim.
Kelly, Joe, and Brody.
Well,
how old are they?
1 and 5.
That looks like a baby over there.
He's turned a year old. He's just still a baby. Big boy body, baby brain.
Pam Parsons from Beckley, West Virginia, is here for the third time with her Dalmatians. Besides the proximity to Madison Square Garden, she appreciates the amenities, especially the indoor doggy park.
They make sure that we have a room to go into and use the bathroom, potty in. That's a big deal, especially when we have some of these dogs that aren't used to the big city life and they don't understand that they can use the bathroom on concrete or asphalt. So the sawdust floors downstairs make it a really, really nice.
The Pennsylvania is more of a canine Olympic village than just a hotel for dogs. Downstairs, at the far end of a ballroom used last week for a training conference, there's that expanse of sawdust and wood shavings dotted with red plastic fire hydrants. Here, a steady stream of WKC competitors get some exercise, socialize, and check P-mail. But the makeshift park is just part of the dog spa, spelled S-P-A-W, where there are plenty of services to get these pooches at peak readiness to strut their stuff before a packed garden.
May we have the toy group in the ring, please?
As the big show approaches, there's no end to the whining of blow dryers at the spa's multiple grooming tables. But what's available here goes more than fur deep. There are treadmills in three dog-friendly sizes for daily workouts. And across the room, you can find the resident dog communicator, spiritualist Annie Germani.
I do see a lot more ribbons around him. So he's going to perform so well for you guys. He's going to do well here, too.
How about more puppies?
You're going to be proud, very proud. That's interesting. I'm seeing six puppies. Six more puppies, okay?
Germani plumbs the inner life of more than 50 dogs over the course of the Westminster show.
I read pets, and I will tell their owner what, you know, they're feeling and what they like and what they don't like. And there are a lot of times when I will tell people that the reason your dog is not performing well is because the dog is so nervous. And a sensitive dog picks up all the negative energy that's going on because people are always in a hurry and people are crabby and that kind of thing.
Jane Hammett Bright has been coming to the Hotel Pennsylvania from Jackson Springs, North Carolina, for the past 15 years. She lives on a 100-acre farm and doesn't have much use for newfangled doggy treadmills. But she has taken to heart what another dog communicator told her about her champion Sheltie Boomer.
She just told me I was putting too much pressure on the dog and that I was not making it fun for him anymore. I used to get angry if I would lose, but that makes sure it's all fun, and I don't get real serious about stuff. If they win, they win. If they don't, they don't. It doesn't change my opinion of the dog.
Dog masseuse Debbie Zimmerman takes a more hands-on approach to preparing her clients for Westminster's rigors. She's come in for the week from California and is leaning over repeat customer Raiden, a 100-pound Akita who's just flown in from Florida.
How often does he get massaged?
Once a year at Westminster.
Good boy, Raiden. Hi. Raiden, down.
They're athletes, and they have to show off what they have, how their structure is and how they look and how they move. That's the key word, movement. And they've got to be able to move and stretch out and show, because basically whoever wins, they're going to get the top dollar in breeding that dog.
What you can't find down here, you may be able to get through Jerry Grimick, the hotel's dog concierge, who's even been known to deliver the breakfasts and dinners of champions.
We do not offer room service in our rooms, and we've gotten requests. I've gotten requests for cheeseburger with no onions, meatballs with extra tomato sauce, chicken sandwiches, pepperoni pizzas.
For the owner or for the dog?
Oh, these are for the dogs. We've had requests before for 5 cheeseburgers for a pug, and apparently it made the coat shiny.
And at day's end, man and dog alike can loosen up at the hotel's penthouse lounge during yappy hour. So, this Chinese crested and a Shih Tzu go into a bar in Midtown Manhattan. You get the picture. Not everyone's staying here. Chicagoan Michael Holskoff, for one, is completely satisfied with the accommodations.
The rooms are quite small. We're a little disappointed in the rooms. We had asked for a premium room, but other than that, we'd like the convenience.
It helps, Holskoff adds, that he's sharing those tight quarters with only the chihuahuas he has in tow. Dog concierge Jerry Grimick, who's also the hotel's publicist, says that the Pennsylvania has burnished its canine credentials since Uno, the winsome beagle who captured Best in Show in 2008, slept here.
About 4 days before, 5 days before when he had checked in, there was this buzz about Uno, this beagle, how cute he is, how friendly. And all of a sudden, it was this big storm, this media buzz about him. And next thing you know, Uno won. You know what the effect is? Everyone now calls for Uno's room.
Now that the dogs have trotted off, the hotel staff can clean up and gear up for the Big East and NIT basketball tournaments next month. They'll be braced for a new wave of Huskies, Salukis, and Bulldogs. There won't, however, be a basketball communicator on the premises. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ron Schachter's Dog Hotel photo gallery or Sadie Babbitt's biathlon photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about the stories you've heard on Only a Game or to get the behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Katarina, the official Only a Game Norwegian elk hound, who voices a concern. Oh, don't worry, girl. I'm sure fellow Norwegian Ann Kristin Affet Flatland will do just fine in the biathlon tomorrow. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week. You know, I just got paid. Yeah, I got my hot rod wheels. So if you want to find out how it feels, call me.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.